LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
2020. Is it 1968 all over again? That plus a tribute to a special friend on this edition of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing. For a change.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
This is The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. Lisa K. Donner and Tim Donner with you today. Scott is not with us, and we want to tell you why. Faithful listeners and viewers of The Uprising will recognize immediately that the cast of characters for this podcast has included me and Lisa and others at various times. But the foundation of The Uprising has always been your host, Scott Cosenza, and Archie, the podcasting dog, the joy, often the inspiration of Scott's life. Well, Scott suffered a great personal loss this week. Archie was taken ill suddenly and severely and died at the age of 14. It's hard to describe the indomitable spirit of the original podcasting dog. There's nothing like a dog. And Archie was everything you could want a dog to be, above all, man's best friend. And he was exactly that to Scott, his best friend. Lisa and I understand the heartbreak, and we're heartbroken as well, because we loved Archie like he was our own. And in the days and weeks ahead, we're confident that the countless wonderful memories of Archie will return the smile to Scott's face as he comes back to his rightful place as host of The Uprising next week.
A beautiful tribute to one of God's great masterpieces, Archie Cosenza. May he rest in peace. So 52 years ago, America was in the midst of civil unrest. Violence was pervasive across the country. There were calls for law and order. Buildings were taken over and occupied by protesters. Cities were set ablaze, and a presidential election was underway. Any of this sound familiar? We thought so, and so we bring you this special edition of the Uprising podcast today. We're talking, of course, of the year of our Lord, 1968. Though young, Tim and I lived through that tumultuous year. And we began to think about the many similarities between 1968 and 2020. Of course, there are differences too, and we acknowledge that. No assassinations, thank God, but oh, so many parallels. Tim, I wanted to start today because you have a unique 1968 story that you have told very few people. And I'd like you, if you're comfortable, to share a bit of that with our Uprising listeners today.
Well, it's a good time to do it, because if I did it with Scott here, he'd just make fun of me endlessly and my overwhelming white privilege, Lace. But I have never told anybody outside of the closest circle this story, because honestly, I kind of thought that many people would think it was made up or exaggerated or fantastical. Yeah, right. You grew up one floor underneath a president of the United States. But in fact, that's what happened. 1960, Richard Nixon loses to John F. Kennedy in the presidential election. 2 years later, he runs for governor of California and is beaten soundly by Pat Brown. He says, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. He quits politics and moves to New York in early 1963 into the same building that my parents and I had moved into maybe 6 to 12 months previous. So saying he's never going to do politics again, it doesn't take long for him to get the itch again. He starts campaigning And right up to 1968, he runs for president again, even though he'd been twice disgraced in the early 1960s and was despised by the media anyway, much like Trump. But he moves into our building and lives one floor. He lives on the fifth floor. We live on the fourth floor. And that's where he lived when he was elected president of the United States, his bedroom immediately above my own. And but it was in the intervening years between 1963 and 68 that he would go to work when I went to school. So at least a couple times a week, I would see him in the elevator. And for a 10, 11, 12, then 13-year-old starstruck teenager just getting interested in politics, oh my God, are you kidding me? The man who may become the next president is moving into our building, lives in our building, and sure enough, you know, and we also saw Julie and Trisha Nixon and got to know particularly Julie quite well because we would see them quite often, and it was all great excitement during the 68 campaign, the very thing the residents of the building had tried to avoid, which was having a big celebrity surrounded by Secret Service agents in ill-fitting suits with bulges in their breast pockets, which is exactly what wound up happening. And there was press all around, and all of this for a 13-year-old kid, I want to tell you, it's something, obviously, I'll never forget.
But there was something even more bizarre about that building. Who else was in that building?
Okay. In that building on the top floor was Nelson Rockefeller. And Nelson Rockefeller and Richard Nixon were bitter rivals in the Republican Party in the 1960s. As a matter of fact, there was a famous meeting in our building in 1960 when Kennedy was running, and it was still undecided as to whether the Republican nominee would be Nixon, who had been Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years and sort of seemed to be, you know, the next guy in line, or Nelson Rockefeller, one of the last great liberal Republicans who thought he could consolidate a new kind of liberal Republicanism. I forget which number president he was, but a president of the United States was elected living one floor above me was the fact that the man who came almost about as close as anyone did to knocking him out of the Republican nomination fight also lived in the same building.
So there you are, folks, stranger than science. And no, this is not an episode of Twilight Zone. All right, tell our listeners and viewers a little bit about the backdrop of the tableau for 1968 in New York City.
Well, it was a time of incredible civil unrest. It was a time of riots in the wake of two major assassinations that year. And as we look back on this, and Lisa, what we're going to talk about today is the incredible similarities between 1968 and 2020. And in 1968, you had two assassinations. In 2020, you had a pandemic. And I almost compare the two in the sense of how much it dispirited the nation. You had Martin Luther King assassinated in April of 1968, and then Bobby Kennedy 2 months later in June. And so the entire country was just shaken to the core, on top of the fact that we were getting out of control violence, riots, buildings being taken over in universities, and the same kind of insurrection that we're seeing in 2020. And living in New York, I didn't just live in the same building with Nixon. I also lived about a mile and a half, 2 miles from Harlem, where riots were going on along with cities all across the country. Sound familiar? And so it was a frightening time to live in New York City because it was, like many of the urban centers at the time, under siege. The anti-war protests combined with black outrage at the assassination of Martin Luther King and the total dispiriting of the nation with the second assassination of RFK, Bobby Kennedy. And I compared the dispiriting of the nation to what this COVID has done in 2020. We haven't had anybody assassinated, but I'll tell you what, the effect on the nation of this damnable pandemic seems to me the equivalent of those two assassinations. And then you look at the urban riots and it's so similar. And you're talking about forces that didn't want to reform the system, forces that wanted to take down the system. Well, just like now.
Yeah, let's take a look at, you know, there is something, I'm wondering if there's like a 50-year thing, because if you go back another 50 years, we're looking at the Bolshevik Revolution, the Spanish flu.
It's almost perfectly congruous, because let's go back 300 years. 2020, you've got the pandemic and out of control violence and insurrection in the streets. 50 years back, give or take, we're in the late 1960s, in 68, 69, 70, and anti-war protests and violence in the streets and on campuses and everywhere. Take it 50 years back from there, and you're talking about the Bolshevik Revolution. Take it back 50 years from there, you're talking about the Civil War in the 1860s. Take it back 50 years from there, you're talking the War of 1812, when the British tried to come back at us after we beat them in the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. And you take it 50 years back from the War of 1812, and you talk about the beginning of the insurrection by the colonists against the British Crown. So it's like a 50-year itch.
Well, let's move forward. I think there really is something to be said for that. I mean, it's very bizarre. And I don't think anybody thought of that as we were moving into 2020. We were just all high on a great economy, and is it going to be another roaring 20s, you know, maybe without the depression this time at the end. It was a real feel-good time for a very short time in 2020. But if we go back to 1968, you had groups like SDS, and a lot of people might not remember that's Students for Democratic Society. Today we have BLM, which is an openly Marxist movement. So, you know, it's interesting to know, to see kind of the parallels from those two organizations. And the methodology of both of them is fairly similar. I mean, it was setting off bombs in public buildings. It was taking over college campuses. It feels very similar.
Yes, it does feel very similar, because, you know, insurrection basically means you're trying to overthrow the government. And these Marxists of Black Lives Matter, and they profess it openly. They don't try to hide it. It's on their website. They are trained Marxists. They've said it. They've written it. It's on their website. And SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was every bit as radical. They wanted to just simply overthrow the existing order without any thought to what would replace it other than open chaos. So there's a real analogy there.
It's interesting, the lingo, though, the verbiage, SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. You know, I mean...
It's people are ruled by rhetoric, and look at Black Lives Matter. I mean, who could argue with the title of the organization? That's why people can be ruled by rhetoric. I think, you know, all the people that support Black Lives Matter out there now, they think it's just a nice racial justice organization for the most part, although they're being educated because it says Black Lives Matter. Who's going to argue with the notion that Black Lives Matter? See, until you look below the surface, and you don't have to look that far to see how radical they are.
But in 68, I think there wasn't the kind of acceptance that we had at first with BLM. I mean, it was on the top of Amazon. It was on baseball diamonds. It was, you know, everywhere. I mean, it was like the world was, so happy to promote Black Lives Matter. And then they started thinking, well, no, maybe not.
Well, I think what Black Lives Matter has done more effectively than SDS did in the 1960s was to play on white guilt. You know, SDS, everybody hated the Vietnam War. Everybody hated it for different reasons. But SDS exploited that and tried to turn, you know, the opposition to the war into a defining issue for white people. And just like Black Lives Matter, they overreached so dramatically that we had the backlash of Richard Nixon promoting law and order in his campaign. It was all law and order. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like the Trump campaign 2020? Law and order, so that you get the backlash against this kind of radical action. I think we won't be able to make the full comparison until we see the result of the election.
So what was the result of, remind everybody what we were looking at.
1968 was just, it was a crazy election, just like it was a crazy year. It was a crazy year, just weird, insane year, just like 2020 is. And so you had, starting the year, it was Lyndon Baines Johnson whose conduct of the Vietnam War had become increasingly unpopular on both sides, both hawks who felt he wasn't giving the military a chance to actually win the conflict, and from the left, which was just anti-war, period. That's back when the left was anti-war. LBJ was considered, well, of course he's going to get the Democratic nomination. Bobby Kennedy might challenge him, but boy, it's tough to oppose a sitting president in the primary in his own party. So,
right, but then you had the famous "I will not sit, yes, nor while I accept."
Bobby Kennedy stood to the side, and then finally, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was completely worn out, he was depressed. He had tried everything to win the Vietnam War and avoid becoming the first president in U.S. history to lose a war. And he knew he couldn't win it. The real tragedy of it was that he knew he couldn't win it. We have the tapes of him saying that, and yet he kept sending our boys off to war to die. And we see to this day the after effects, the aftershocks, the national PTSD of Vietnam. People who went to war and then were treated for a cause they didn't understand in a war that we lost, who, when they came home, they were treated as if there was something wrong with them.
Right, but they came home to, it was a nut house. No, I mean, you know, there's
people
in
protesting
the streets,
against them.
They're burning draft cards. It was really shameful, I think, the way we treated those Vietnam veterans when they came home.
It's one of the great shames of this nation.
Yeah, I agree.
Vietnam vets were treated when they came home, and we see how deeply disturbed so many of them are, which you would be too, and I would be, if you were sent to fight a war thousands of miles away in a jungle, in an unwinnable war. You weren't given the chance to win, and then you were injured spiritually, emotionally, physically, and then you come home and were treated with contempt. I would have problems.
Okay, let's get back to the election. So it was Nixon, Humphrey, and Wallace, right?
Well, we have to finish off the LBJ piece first, because he shocked the world in mid-March of that year by saying, I will not seek, nor will I accept.
Right.
So he drops out of the race. This is a president refusing to seek re-election. So that throws everything open. So then Humphrey, who was the vice president, Hubert Humphrey, an old-time liberal, was brought forward as the candidate of the establishment, and a loyal soldier, a career politician, but a rather committed, you know, rather principled liberal. But he had to do a lot of backspins to support LBJ on the war. So this was a party already weakened. Now Humphrey's brought forward as an establishment candidate as an LBJ replacement. Eugene McCarthy rises up as an anti-war candidate, and he does well in a couple of primaries. Actually, it was McCarthy's performance in New Hampshire that forced LBJ out. It was after the first primary in New Hampshire. McCarthy didn't win, but LBJ was significantly weakened and then pulled out. McCarthy had a run. Then Bobby Kennedy gets into it, and everybody figured that will change the whole race. And he had just finished winning the California primary, which probably would have propelled him to the nomination, even though a lot of backroom deals were made then. Probably would have propelled him. They probably couldn't have stopped him from the nomination. And he was assassinated that night. So that then threw the whole thing into a complete uproar. And Hubert Humphrey winds up winning at a convention in Chicago that is the stuff of legend. What Richard Daley and the Chicago law enforcement did to quell the demonstrations and the tear gas and the beatings and the injuries, and people died, and it was a humiliation for the Democratic Party, for the nation, and Nixon's just sitting there saying, keep it going, because it's all benefiting me.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see some of the footage, because there were thousands of people, but they wouldn't let them near the convention center, so that they had to push them off to a park. And, you know, there were, you know, the Jane Fondas and all those people there, Hayden, and the cops were actually keeping them at bay to the tune of a couple of miles away.
Yes.
I mean, Chicago was like a police state.
It was literally a police state, because the police were ruling the city. Not in a defensive posture, but in an offensive posture. They were taking aggressive action because Dick Daley, the ultimate machine politician, along with a guy like Frank Rizzo in Philadelphia, he just wasn't going to have these hippies and these draft dodgers control the mojo in his town, and boy, did he make sure that didn't happen. But the Democrats paid a steep price.
Right. I think Rizzo was much later, though.
Oh, Rizzo was much later, but well in the not much later, but well in the tradition of Dick Richard Daley.
Okay, sure. So you have this melee at the Democratic convention. That police are being called pigs, and we'll get into the anti-police rhetoric in another section of the show. But so what about the RNC convention?
Well, that was pretty uneventful. There was a lot of jockeying for position between Nixon and Rockefeller. And then Ronald Reagan got into it at the very end as well. In 1968, people forgot, because of course he ran in 76. And then he ran and won in 1980, but he actually got in late in 1968. So you had Rockefeller, and you had Nixon, and you had Reagan. Nixon, Rockefeller, and Reagan. Talk about a trio of heavyweights. And Reagan was.
And then in the middle of all this, you had George Wallace. Without George Wallace, he would have had maybe 50 more electoral votes. It would have been a landslide. But with George Wallace, it seemed closer than it really was.
For people who follow elections closely, if Wallace had not won, George Wallace, who is an openly pro-segregationist candidate, who was a Democrat, who then ran as an independent.
Let's not forget.
Yeah. He was a Democrat.
And what states did he carry?
He carried the five deep states in the deep South: Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, one other, and those are all states that Nixon would have won. So if Wallace wasn't running, Nixon would have won the same type of victory that Barack Obama won over Mitt Romney in 2012. In other words, not a landslide, but very decisive. But Nixon still won by 100 electoral votes. He got 300 give or take a couple electoral votes. He would have had about 350
which is about what Obama got in 2012.
Yeah, so we had the establishment, law, race. Race was a major issue. The assassination of Martin Luther King, the demonstrations that were going on all over the South, there were beatings, there were hoses put on people, sitting at lunch counters, and it was very tumultuous.
I mean, it was not dissimilar to what's going on now. Now, the difference is that what sparked the insurrection this year was the killing of, or execution, whatever you want to call it, of George Floyd, which you would say, okay, that was a horrendous thing that you had to turn away. You couldn't even watch it. And I'm talking about everybody, black and white, that I've talked to and heard talk about it and seen and read and whatever. If you compare 2020 to 1968, in 2020 was the death of a guy, George Floyd, who we later found out had a pretty long, ugly criminal record himself. That's what sparked these months of riots that are still going on. In 1968, it was the assassination of Martin Luther King, who was a legitimate figure for racial justice, who had eschewed violence, who in fact insisted that violence not be associated with his movement for the very reason that he understood that if all you got was violence, that's the only message that was going to be sent out, and the message of racial justice was going to be buried. And that's essentially what happened in the election. They said, we just need law and order above all else, and we're going to vote for Nixon, even though, look, Nixon was hardly more popular than Donald Trump. He's a really controversial figure, not nearly as outspoken, a lot more establishment than Trump, but a guy who was hated by the media and the left almost as much.
Oh, absolutely. Now, let's just take a quick break here and remind our listeners and viewers that LibertyNation.com is the sponsor of today's Uprising podcast. Please hit our website, sign up for our daily briefing, hit our new Roku channel, and just enjoy the site. We would love to have you check us out. Anyway, let's go back a little bit to 68 and talk about the media. I think that's one issue that, I won't say it's parallel, but you could see the emergence of opinion over fact. There was a quote by, I believe, Walter Cronkite. He was making judgments. He wasn't just reporting the news.
It's true. That's a very insightful point, because especially, it was really Vietnam that did it. Because Cronkite, you know, it brings to mind Woodward here, and then the latest Woodward book about Trump, and how, you know, Woodward scrupulously for years, through his entire career, from the Watergate thing all the way forward to all the books he's written, what is it, 9 of them about 4 or 5 different presidents, and he always insisted that he was going to be just the facts only. But then Trump put him over the edge, apparently, because in this book, this latest book, where Trump supposedly said that, well, they have the tape of it. He said he was trying to downplay the pandemic, of course, explaining that he didn't want to panic the nation. I don't know what's wrong with that. But in any case, Walter Cronkite was always the guy, the most trusted man in America. Let's put it that way. He was the most trusted man in America. And part of it was because he didn't betray a bias, even though he had one. He was liberal. He was always liberal. But he was liberal. He wasn't a radical. But when he went to Vietnam and he saw what he saw, he decided that he was going to go beyond just the facts. And he basically said, this is an unwinnable war. And this is a horror show that we're in. And I think that did probably begin to change journalism. I agree with you.
He also said, I believe it was at the Democratic National Convention, that, you know, America was becoming a police state.
Yeah. It was pretty hard for reporters not to give a point of view when they were covering the chaos and the violence surrounding the police incited, and not in every instance, police incited and demonstrator incited riots in 1968 during the convention, because none of these people had seen anything like this at a political convention before. It was absolute bedlam. You had fights breaking out on the convention floor in Chicago between the pro-war and anti-war factions, the LBJ people who were defending our presence in Vietnam, and the many forces, though they weren't a majority, anti-war, who wanted McCarthy.
Yeah, well, you know, in there is nothing new under the sun category. You know, you had issues with police, issues with the media. You had law and order with the elections going on. You had the war in Vietnam, which was a major issue. Then let's not forget the 1968 Olympics. And I've actually pulled up something from, I don't know if it's history.com, but I just want to read this to you for a second. After being awarded gold and bronze medals, respectively, in the 200-meter sprint event in the Summer Olympics in Mexico City, U.S. athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos bowed their heads and raised their black glove fists in a recognized salute to... Was it Black Power, Black Panthers?
Black Power.
Yeah. Okay, it was during the Star Spangled Banner. So this business of taking a knee, you know, taking a knee is not new, basically.
And I think that's what this whole podcast is about, isn't it, Liz? That there's nothing new under the sun, straight out of Ecclesiastes, but it's empiric, can be empirically proven. When you look at the 50-year thing that I talked about, the insurrection, every 50 years, revolution arises from the masses, no matter whether it's in the form of the kind we're getting now, where you'd think that Marxism would long have been relegated to the ash heap of history once the world learned of the horrors of Soviet Russia and Mao's China and Pol Pot and all the associated Marxist, Leninist, totalitarian dictators, and the march of death numbering into the tens or hundreds of millions. How is a philosophy like this able to rise again? And the point is that I think the 50-year thing has a lot to do with people have short memories. And people say, well, it'll be different this time. And they don't remember what happened 50 years ago. They don't remember maybe what happened 40 years ago. I mean, we're now almost 30 years past the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and which was all about exactly the thing that now Black Lives Matter is trying to bring to life again in our own country.
Right, but these people don't let facts get in their way. They want what they want when they want it. And, you know, and if you dare to not agree with them, you're immediately an enemy. Going back to 68 a little bit, looking at LeBron James and the things that he said, I it's really hard to wrap your brain around. I don't want to be friends with any white people.
He said that early in his career. Now he's, you know, what he is now, on top of being an ignorant default radical, like I'm LeBron, so I'm going to act all militant, so all my BLM brothers will love me. This is a guy who lives, the entire NBA lives off of China. They live off the ratings and the merchandising they get in China. And it's all controlled by Nike. It's Nike and China and the NBA. Let's not forget what LeBron James said when Hong Kong protester had risen to the point where the communists in Beijing had to put down the uprising. He basically said, "Well, freedom of speech can be very dangerous," and he basically supported the idea that the NBA basically would not recognize the rights of the individuals in Hong Kong because they were all tied to China. So you know what? Into Nike. So you know it all revolves around a perverse partnership between the NBA and Nike and China. And so, you know, LeBron James is just disgracing himself every time he opens his mouth and speaks without any semblance of in-depth knowledge of what he's talking about.
I want to go back a little bit and talk about, you know, the groups that were forming. We talked about the Students for Democratic Society. We talked about the Black Panthers.
Yes.
But, you know, it's interesting. I think there is a nexus between Antifa and the Yippies.
Yes.
You know, these were, you know, well, affluent, I guess you could call them fairly.
Rich white kids.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm putting it in the simplest term. Rich white kids. And now you have Antifa. And if you put up mugshots of these Antifa people, you know, that. If you change the clothes and the hair, you've got the Yippies.
It's true, and you don't even probably have to change the clothes or the hair that much. Doing it with a kind of impunity that still just shocks the conscience, how these rich white kids, who they're rich because they live in a country that allows them to be that way, and yet they hate themselves. They have such a self-loathing for everything that's made them what they are and about their heritage. I would love to see an in-depth profile of a group of Antifa protesters Antifa insurrectionists who could really talk in some depth about what makes them hate their country so much, because I can't understand it. I mean, it's a lot more than just, you know, conventional liberal guilt or being a limousine liberal or a Marie Antoinette let them eat cake. It's much more advanced than that. And you're right. The Yippies were like that. They were insane, off the wall, doing things that were just like guerrilla attacks on various targets.
Yeah, and on TV you were seeing bloody clashes between police and demonstrators. You know, the cops all had riot gear and were beating people with billy clubs. And I think today, though, you're not getting that kind of response, maybe as much from the police.
Well, I mean, the police didn't become the source of such abuse writ large in the 1960s, because most people recognized that the police were the only ones that could put down these riots.
But it did with the anarchists. They were the ones calling them pigs and bacon and this, right, that, and the other.
The difference is that they weren't able to consolidate public opinion around that idea, whereas this year they were. But now I think you're seeing the pushback against it. And the recognition, I think this is the most important point to be made about this business about defund the police, or the way the clever leftists like to put it is reimagine the police. The thing about it is that is that the people who will be hurt the most, hit the hardest, injured the worst, are the very people that these protesters and these defunders purport to be protecting.
Right,
which
right,
is
right.
Minority communities are the ones that need cops the most. Hello?
Yeah, but again, they don't care, because whatever is in their way, you know, they need to make their point.
Well, we'll see who cares, because we'll see what percentage of the black vote Trump might be able to garner this year, because black people are fed up with it too.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, this week we saw a lot of, you know, Joe Biden trying to reach out to the Hispanic community. It was a little pathetic, but we won't go into that.
Jeez, that's a whole podcast in itself, Liz.
Yeah, when he played the song on his cell phone.
I thought it was a joke. I thought that somebody had actually, he gets up there, for those of you uninitiated and don't perseverate about these things. Joe Biden got up there at a Hispanic unity rally. What was it, in Florida? I think it was. And he gets up there and with this teeny little, looked like a Walkman from the 1990s or something, awkwardly hits the play button.
Oh, I thought it was like on his iPhone or something.
Well, maybe it was that. I mean, he could barely touch the play button. And he finally did, and he played some popular song among
Latin
the Hispanics
song,
or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so awkward. You were like embarrassed for him just watching it on TV.
Well, I think one of the reasons Trump is looking good with minorities is because of the economy. And everybody knows that we were flying pretty high before the COVID. Unemployment for blacks was its lowest in history. And we saw the town hall this week of Trump. In fact, there is going to be one with Biden. But the one that we saw was Trump on ABC. And
with the undecided voters. If you watch that, those voters were not undecided. It's so transparent. Maybe a couple of them were. But you get an angry black woman up there, interrupting the president, saying, "Excuse me, sir, let me finish," to the president of the United States with an angry, narrative that she's running out of. Oh, yeah, she's undecided. Sure.
But the point I was going to make was that one guy got up there and said, your slogan is "Make America Great Again." Well, America was never great for us. Fair enough.
Yes.
But what Trump said back in 2015, how's this working for you, all this Democratic stuff? And I think blacks were wary to vote for him. But I think this time, he put his administration where his mouth is. The problem with the media is they get caught up in trying to twist his words. Or what was it Tom Cotton said?
The media wing of the Democratic Party, Senator Tom Cotton said that was marvelous. That's the best way to put it. And I think the Democrats are sweating because Trump is relentless in going after black votes. He's absolutely, I don't know whether he will get a lot of them. I suspect he will. And when I say a lot, maybe from 8% last time up to the 12 to 15% range.
Right,
I consider that the single most interesting sub-element of this election is how Trump does with black voters.
Right, and he said, I'm not racist. I mean,
black people are just like us. They want law and order in their communities. They don't want things being burned down. They don't want riots and buildings being burned and lasers being pointed at police, at the eyes of police, and communities being ripped apart by these losers who have nothing better to do than to try and make themselves significant in their own eyes for some reason. I have no
right,
idea.
But you have to look past what he says and the way it's twisted in the media to what he has done.
Right. He can point to actual achievements.
Exactly.
He gave them jobs. I mean, is it basically, do you want welfare or do you want a job? Do you want the government to hand you money or do you want me to work to build an economy that will give you a job and dignity and a way to support yourself and not be dependent on others? I mean, that's basically what he's done, and the Democrats just want to increase the welfare state. Now they want another $3 trillion in a package for COVID. It's just the spigot never turns off for the left.
All right, as we studied this 1968-2020 nexus, I think in the end, we both felt a little bit of a sigh of relief. There was something comforting about it. What was it?
Well, for me, it was comforting to watch 1968 because I see where we've landed, where we landed after it. We're not in a good place now, but within I would say 6 to 10 years after 1968, we were fully into the me generation. which was a reaction to let's all go collective and try to save the world in the 1960s to the 70s leading into the 80s, where it's, okay, let's turn our attention to ourselves. Let's turn my attention to myself. And this is a natural societal reaction in the back and forth, the give and take of movements over time. When you have this kind of radicalism, there's going to be a pushback from people that just want normality, normalcy again. And I think this is going to happen here too. The left has changed the whole conversation to the point where I think normal Americans are forced to be defensive and maybe make a defensive vote for Donald Trump. Or in the case of black people, you know, Trump's got three different things that could happen. He could get, let's say, the same amount as last time, the same black people that voted for him last time voting for him this time. Or he can get a lot more of them voting for him this time, up to 12%, say, or more. Mm-hmm. Or he can just make it so that black people who can't quite, that is a bit of a bridge too far to actually pull the lever for Donald Trump, given how they've been bombarded with the idea that he's a racist white supremacist, maybe they could, the solution that Trump would accept is that those people simply don't vote at all. So that he's still depriving Joe Biden of a vote, even if he's not getting that vote.
In looking back at 1968, for me, the comforting thing was that despite all the horrific stuff going on, and really those two assassinations were, you know, that really set things awry.
They really did.
But what was comforting to me is that we made it through.
Right.
I mean, we made it to the other side. And I think that this is why history is so important. This is why you don't want to tear down the statues. This is why you want to look back at what you did wrong and what you did right. This is why you want to try to understand the generations before you. Because you want to be able to see what happened as a result. And what happened in 1968 is that Richard Nixon was elected. And if it hadn't been for, as we said, George Wallace, it could have been by a very wide margin. But we also, as a country, as a society, we made it through. We came to the other side. And I think this year has been so tough on so many. I mean, the coronavirus, like you said, it's our Vietnam. It's our war that we've been fighting. And it has claimed a lot of lives. But it hasn't. I think it changed America, but I don't think it has conquered America. And I don't think it has conquered the people. But I guess the reason I really wanted to do this program with you is because I wanted to bring a larger perspective to 2020, because it's so easy to get caught up in the minutia. It's so easy to go down the road of, you know, everything's horrible, nothing's ever going to get better. Everything is horrible, but it is going to get better. That's my thinking.
That's brilliantly stated. It really is. I can't really add much to that except to say that I agree that we made it through. We've always made it through. We made it through an impossible situation in 1776 when our forces were pinned down in New York City, and only a miracle fog that made the British unable to complete the destruction of Washington's army.
Well, was it true when he was in New York, he stayed one floor below? Just kidding.
Yeah, yes, right. Right. No, that was a different president, at least. But we've seen we made it through the Civil War, for heaven's sake. That was 600,000 soldiers and over 1 million people total that died in the Civil War. We made it through the pandemic of 1918. We made it through World War I. We fought essentially two wars. World War II was two wars, one to the west and one to the east, two world wars at the same time. And we got through 1968 and assassinations, and we got through Watergate. We've always landed on our feet. And I think the point is, again, let's end where we started with Ecclesiastes. There's really, as much as you might think, nothing like this could ever have happened before. It could never have been this bad before. there's nothing new under the sun.
And I continue to be hopeful that as 2020, the year 2020 rings out and 2021 rings in, this nation will still be standing. Its people may have been changed, but my hope is that they've been strengthened, and that as a society, we will learn how to come together and how to defeat the enemies of freedom and liberty.
And on that note, we want to thank you for indulging Lisa and me this week, sitting in for Scott, and hopefully we've enlightened you a little bit. We've lived through a lot and shared a lot of it today. We thank you for joining us. This is a podcast of LibertyNation.com. Don't forget Liberty Nation Radio, too, also available on LibertyNation.com. Don't forget our Roku channel, and you're not going to get better election coverage anywhere. Trust me.
Scott Cosenza will be back next week with you. And until then, liberty all the time and everywhere.
Stay ahead of the curve with LibertyNation.com. With one click, you get tomorrow's news today with LNTV's Hot Topics and Analysis, Liberty Nation Radio, The Uprising and Rabbit Hole Podcasts, and dozens of insightful original articles. And now, you can keep your kids ahead of the curve with LNGenZ.com. LNGenZ brings a free-thinking education right into your home for students of every grade level with articles, videos, worksheets, and ready-to-go curriculum. While the media establishment giants are sleeping, you can stay ahead of the curve with LibertyNation.com and get tomorrow's news today. LibertyNation.com.